Now friends, as already said, the topic of our discussion this evening is Yoga of Impersonality. Yoga, as we all know, comes from the root yuj, to join, to yoke, to be assimilated with, to be connected with. And yukta is one who is so assimilated, who is so yoked, who is so connected. It refers to the union of human self with his higher self, which is the Lord of all creatures. We have 10 propositions of psychology in theosophy. One of the propositions speaks of the true nature of man, constitution of man. We usually refer to human beings, man, we refer to ourselves as mere personal forms, name and form and body. When I say I mean the body. It is due to lack of correct thinking. What the psychological, the axiom of psychology, one of the axioms says is that what we see is only an outer man, visible man. And within this invisible man is an inner invisible man who is separable from the outer. The vital principle of the outer and the thinking self. And this vital principle and the thinking self having the subtle electromagnetic energy form, vital force, has this outer covering body. And overbrooding the outer and the inner man is the supreme spirit, which is the source of all forces and alone eternal, whereas the other two change. And the proposition further goes on to say that when the inner man succeeds in merging himself with spirit, his true self, then he becomes an immortal entity and partakes of the omniscience and omnipotence of spirit. This is a great science. The way by which the understanding, complete knowledge of these laws and principles and ways and means by which the inner man may work his way out of the delusion that he is the form and realize his identity with the Supreme and merge with it, is Yoga Vidya. He partakes of omniscience and omnipotence of spirit and he becomes an immortal entity. He becomes a godly man. And this science is called Yoga Vidya. In the Western Hemisphere, in the ancient tradition of the Western Hemisphere, it is called magic. Not magic in the vulgar connotation of the term these days. It means spiritual wisdom. The whole process of this supreme effort of working our way out of this illusion of personality, separateness, and realizing our true identity, which we call the great science of yoga, is extremely difficult. So difficult it is that Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that out of thousands of mortals, perhaps one may make an attempt in this direction. And out of 1,000 who make such an attempt, perhaps one may succeed. That is in any one life. The difficulty arises because of the personal idea that we have. Personal idea in the sense, the feeling, intense feeling, I am this body. I am separate from others. So with this delusion, naturally, selfishness arises. So the motive for man so deluded would be selfish interest. And to overcome this is the great difficulty. Now, what Yoga Vidya says is that the basic truth, the fundamental truth of existence is that there is but one life, one consciousness, one spirit, not many. And this one life, one consciousness, one spirit, infinite, boundless, assumes various forms, become individualized in those forms, attain to individual consciousness. And individual consciousness so emanated from, arising from the one life, attached to form, becomes deluded by the matter, that is, the forms in which it is confined, and thinks itself separate from others. This personal idea arising out of our true self is very difficult to surmount. And the basic truth is there is but one self, one consciousness, one life. And the sense of separateness that we feel is an illusion. It is like sun hidden by thick, dark clouds. We haven't seen the sun. We think this diffused light is all life. It is not all true light. When the clouds are dispersed, you see the light in its, in all its brilliance. Similarly, when this illusion of separateness is overcome, then we realize that we were misled into thinking that we were separate, but actually we are one. All beings dwell in us, and we, the true self in all beings, this realization comes. And this realization is yoga. In the Voice of the Silence, it is said that the aspirant must work his way out of his bodily form, full of sensation, personal feeling of personality. Within this feeling of personality, in your consciousness, look deeply within. Seek in the impersonal for the eternal man. And if you look deep, you are a Buddha, not this mortal clay. In the impersonal, eternal man is universal. He is eternal. He is impersonal. So, it is overcoming this sense of separateness, the personal idea, and realizing our true self, which is impersonal. Impersonal because it is, as Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, which we just now read out, it is free from the personal predilections that we all have, likes, dislikes, hate, love, anger. It is free from all that. It is all. It is universal harmony, self of all. Omniscient, omnipotent. So, in this one life arises this individuality and the personality. And it is due to this sense of separateness that we feel while in the body. It is because of our tendency to identify ourselves with form, with desires, with our feelings. So from this arises intense desire, kama, as instinct of self-preservation. Instinct of self-preservation. And from that arises a thirst for life. Thirst for life and more life. Life in the sensation, in this enjoyment of sensation life. And therefore, all actions, our thinking and feeling and actions have for their motive, naturally, self-interest. So, whatever accord with our self-interest, we think it's good, it is pleasant, pleasant, happiness, and whatever militates against our desires, our expectations, our wishes, we think it is evil, we dislike it, we think it is sorrowful. So, now, therefore, our motive for action will be selfish, desire bound, and when it is desire bound, invariably it also gives rise to anger, hatred, envy, jealousy, and all these negative qualities. And action we do with a personal motive of gain, self-interest, produces far-reaching moral, mental, and physical effects. It produces far-reaching, we produce causes which by selfish action, selfish thought, and it produces far-reaching action on the moral, mental, and physical plane, producing various conditions by which we become bound. So this is called karma, the law of ethical causation. And this acts automatically. And this law of cause and effect, which adjust every effect to its appropriate cause through the individual who produces the cause, is impersonal law. It acts with unvarying regularity, equity, justice. It cannot be wished away. It cannot be prayed to and made to divert. It is impersonal law. So it is universal harmony, it is the law of our being. And our personal identity, personal self, personality, what remains of it at death? When we die, what do we leave behind? We leave behind nothing but the causes we have sown. You know, of merit and demerit. And that's about all that will cling to or will be imperishable center of causation which our higher ego takes upon itself. The higher ego becomes the carrier of these causes that we have produced, and it is truly the moral kernel of a man. Nothing remains of the personality, everything is dispersed. The name and form is gone, but the mental and physical tendencies and characteristics remain as potentialities, potential seeds, which will form another body, another circumstances, in which the ego becomes embodied. And all the while, the true individuality, the higher ego, remains unaffected. It is a witness of this all, impersonal higher ego. Now, therefore, what we call this personality is nothing but a product of karma and a maker of karma. So it is nothing but a bundle of instinctual desires, mental characteristics, which keep on altering as we alter our ways of thinking and our emotional life and aspirations. So the higher ego therefore becomes the embodied karma. It is the very law itself. It is a moral kernel which alone survives and becomes the cause for subsequent manifestations of personality. So we see here there is a self-personal and the self-impersonal. Self-personal, as already said, is the product of our own karma and maker of karma, constantly reproducing itself because of the undying desire for existence in matter, thirst for life. And overbrooding this is the higher ego, not taking part but witness of it all, and overshadows the mortal, self-impersonal. So as long as we maintain this personal idea, as long as we maintain this personal idea, we are subject to this law of ethical causation, and there is no way by which we can free ourselves from the meshes of conditioned existence which bind us down with all its consequences of delusion and sorrow and relative happiness which invariably ends in disappointment and sorrow. Therefore, we are continuously acting. Action is not by body. Body is only a cadaver. It is an irresponsible factor. So what is it that acts through the body and gives the body its tendencies is the inner man, the thinking entity, the personal self, who is a reflection of the higher individuality. It is action is in the mind. Without mind, there is no action at all. And it is our desire or feeling or emotion is the propeller of action. We may have an idea, but that idea will never translate into action unless we have desire, kama. So this complex thought desire complex is the personal man, personality. And the real basis of action is the mind. Where there is no mind, there is no action. And therefore, there is no karma. A very important axiom that we must remember. And this mind desire complex is the lower self, the egotism. It is the basis of action, the matrix of action, the womb of action, and it is action itself and its own result, reproducing itself constantly. But we are not this egotism, that we must remember. We are not this egotism. So freedom from this meshes of conditioned existence through delusion comes from personal idea, and freedom from this personal idea can only be possible by knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of true self. And that is to acquire the philosophical knowledge of what we are truly, what our true being and true self is, and our constitution, how we are related to the universe, how we have come from, how did we arise, how are we related to others and to the universe, and what's our destiny, the law of our being. This knowledge must be acquired, and with that knowledge attain to a discriminative knowledge of the true self as opposed to the apparent self which we think we are. And with that discriminative knowledge, cease to identify ourselves with what is not self. And when we practice this persistently, we develop a dispassion for what is not self and an aspiration for what is true self and the truth of things. And this will gradually lead to the realization of impersonal self. This process is the yoga of impersonality. And this has to be, this meditative process has to be continuous, unceasing, a kind of an undercurrent of thought throughout our life, in all our in all our daily actions. Have this undercurrent of thought going, that we are not this, our true self is not this, and meditate on the true self and disconnect internally, relinquish self-interest, self-identification with fluctuations of thoughts, emotions, ideas, knowledge, beliefs. This process is the process of yoga of impersonality. So, meditation on true self and what is not true self. Let's consider it in a little more detail. We all can do it. This is true yoga. Now, we all know that we are not the body, theoretically. And yet, after even having studied so much, we have such a strong personal idea, we invariably think that we are the body. We deal with each other as personalities, as bodies. So this is a delusion that we must overcome. Constantly bear in mind, this my body, I am not this body. I am not the sensations. The sight that I see, I am seeing, but I am not the sight, nor the thing I see. I am not the hearing, I am not the smell, nor the instrument through which I experience the sense of smell. I am not the taste. I am not the touch. Though I experience all these sensations of sight, hearing, touch, taste, experience it. Still, while experiencing it, internally we can dissociate ourselves with that experience, stand apart. I am not this. And not only stand apart, but refuse internally with exercise of determination and will, I am not going to fall prey to this. If it is necessary for me to experience, for instance, eating and the food while enjoying the food, is necessary? Yes. If it is not necessary, merely for the desire of it, I will not self-control to do what is necessary and refrain from doing what is necessary through this process of internal disconnection, through discrimination between what is self and not self. Similarly, we have desires, we have emotions. At one time we are angry, at another time we are depressed, there is sorrow, and emotions keep on happy, fluctuating from time to time, from moment to moment. But there is an observer of all this fluctuating emotions. We are not these emotions. When I am depressed, then I must stand apart, aside, internally, and say, I am not this. You are definitely not this. We can every one of us can experience it. Then, by dwelling upon something opposite of what is depressing me, something on positive, happy thing, I overcome it. So I have changed it. So I am different. I am not these emotions. Nor am I all this various kinds of thoughts that come to my mind, the ideas that I hold, and the beliefs that I have, and the knowledge that I possess today. I am not any of these things, because all these things keep on changing, but I remain changeless, and I also, not changing with them, I am able to enlarge them, change them. Therefore, I am not any of these things. We must meditate on those lines. And the true self supports, energizes, and sustains all these processes of the sensation, of emotions, of thoughts, of intellection. What is the basis and power and sustainer of all this? It is the self. It is one consciousness. And further, this self, though sustains and supports all, yet it is free. The ego, experiencing all this, thoughts, emotions, sensations, yet desires, yet it is free. If we study Brihadaranyaka Upanishads on this, it gives us a wonderful theme for meditation. When we go to sleep, the ego is free. The ego is free from the body. The Upanishads say that he has left all evil away and goes to his original place, and he is free God. And all evil is put behind. And when he resumes the body at waking, he seems to assume all the sins that he had apparently has committed. It goes to show that real self is free. It is unaffected, unattached. That we must always remember. It is a witness of all this. So, therefore, true self is a creator of conditions and circumstances in which we find ourselves, we being the true self. And as long as we choose to sustain, maintain the same ideas, same beliefs, knowledge, desires, which produces the condition, we remain in that condition, and what sustains is the true self, the spirit. And the moment we see need for a change of our ideas and beliefs, or compelled to do so because we see better, then our whole circumstances and condition change. So we are the creator, we are the destroyer, and we are the sustainer and regenerators. And all the time remaining free from all this creation, sustenance and regeneration. So, spirit in the body. True self is spirit in the body. In the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says, spirit in the body is called Maheshwara. Now, what a great thought this is. Spirit in the body is called Maheshwara, the great Lord. He is the witness. He is the witness, the sustainer.
Enjoyer.
And Paramatma, the highest soul. So, it is a powerful thought. It's a very powerful thought. He's an admonisher. He's a sustainer. He's an enjoyer. And he's a witness. So, we are that. And so is everyone that. This is overcoming delusion. And constantly meditate on that and hold to that and act from that basis. Now, because we study and because we make an effort to do these exercises, that doesn't mean we're going to realize it so easily. It doesn't come so easily. It requires a constant, lifelong, and life after life meditation. The teacher says, realization comes from dwelling upon the thing to be realized. This is true even in ordinary cases. Whatever we want to accomplish in life, in ordinary life, unless we set our heart upon it, think about it, work upon it, we are not going to attain it. Nobody is going to give us a gift. We have to obtain it. Similarly here, if you have to realize our true self through the practice of the yoga of impersonality, we have to work upon it. Take that knowledge, apply that knowledge, use discriminative knowledge, separate self from not self, and through dispassion, and constant building upon and action on that basis, realization gradually begins to dawn. So promise the teachers. Now, there are many lines of thought we can pursue in this practice of the yoga of impersonality. Now, take another line of thought. In all these changes that we see, experience every day, year after year, week after week, year after year, there is a persistency of self-identity. There is persistency of self-identity in us. Our body has changed unrecognizably. It was an infant. The body was an infant. We were in those infant body. And we grew into childhood and became youths. And now some of us are middle-aged and some of us are in old age. And surely we cannot escape. Decrepitude and death will strike us. But through all these changes, there is one persistent self-identity. We must meditate on that persistent self-identity. And moment to moment change is going on. Every moment neurons are dying and new neurons are born. Millions of them. And cells are changing. Every 7 years, complete body is changed. But self-identity continues. That means the self is eternal. If it is eternal, it is universal. If it is universal, it is one. Not many. So reasoning, you know, this reasoning process must take place. And again, another line of thought, our everyday experience of the three states in which we exist. The waking state, now we are aware of the happenings in the waking state. And when we go to sleep, we are aware of what's going on in the dream state. And when we go to deep sleep, even beyond the dream state, we are aware of what's going on in the deep sleep also, but though we may not be able to recollect the experiences of deep sleep state. Though in all this, the self is the same. Is the self in waking different from the self in dream? Is the self in dream different from self in deep sleep? No. It is one consciousness, as Mr. Judge shows, which pierces up and down through all the states and all the planes. Is one consciousness, and that one consciousness upholds the memory of all these states. Why we do not know it? Because we, in our waking life, our waking consciousness, we continuously choose to live in desires and selfishness and have been unable to get rid of this personal idea and tune our consciousness to that, our true self, which is one, which pierces through and upholds all these different states. So this is another line of meditation that we can pursue. Now, just like dream, so is death. There's a perfect correspondence between sleep and death. What is the difference? In sleep, the body remains. It is alive, though unconscious. Unconscious in the sense, it is not conscious of happening around. So because the inner self, the instrument, has become unfit for work because of overpowering life force, which has incapacitated it for some time. And we live in dream state. From dream state, we go to deep sleep state. And then we return to the waking consciousness through the dream state. In death, the similar thing happens with this difference, that in death it is a permanent sleep. The body is gone and buried or burnt, as the case may be. But analogous to dream and the deep sleep states goes on in the internal post-mortem states. And the ego, just like returns to waking state, so its karmic causes that it produced will fashion another tabernacle, circumstances, conditions in which the ego will return. Through all these changes of daily infancy to old age, through all the three states of human existence, from one life to another life, it is the same echo, same consciousness, same I am a consciousness, goes through unchanged. Must meditate on that. Therefore, as already said, if self is eternal, it must be universal. Therefore, self is not one, it is. Self is not many, self is all. There is not many selves, it is but one self. It is the same self in all. And try to visualize this. The same self is in all, and all is in self. And then when we do this constant exercise and relate, then gradually our personal idea begins to loosen. Our motive of self-interest shifts gradually into one of altruism. More than self-interest, the interest of our fellow men, our duty to our fellow beings gains momentum and strength. So personal idea begins to loosen. And this is how in daily life, while meditating, you fall back on the self. There's a very nice teaching given in the Voice of the Silence. It says, shun praise, O devotee. You know, when somebody praises, we feel very happy. And it says, it is natural for us to feel happy. But a yogi will meditate on this. I am not the self. Shun praise, O devotee. You are not the body. Self has no body. Self is in itself without a body. Praise or blame affects it not. Self is not affected by it. So if you are deluded, you are elated by praise. And then if you are deluded, then we are downcast when somebody is blames us. This way the exercise comes. Stand apart. Look upon praise or blame with equal mindedness. Knowing well that you are free, nothing can touch you. It is true, nothing can touch you. If you only do this little exercise, we are convinced nothing can touch us. So, there is a very nice exercise Mr. Judge prescribes in his teachings. That is, self is not one, self is not many, there is but one spirit, one self. So, the meditation that we can do is, look, I am there with all my friends, relations, people known to me, I am them. I go to each one of them individually in my thought, I am them. There's no difference between the self of my so-and-so and so-and-so friend and myself. If you come to think of it, it's true. And then people known to me, then people, many people unknown to me, I go over them mentally, I am them, self, them. Then I go to all my other friends who are, other people who are inimical to me, my enemies, I go over to each one of them. Say, I am them also. And then I go to mentally to all the people living in Bangalore. Says, I am every one of them. Good, bad and indifferent. I am them. Same self. Then I go to whole of India. The 1.1 billion people. I am the same. The self the same. Then I go to each country. China, Mexico, USA. I go to whole of mankind, whole of mankind. I am each one of them. I am collectively all. The self is the same. Then the middle kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, the invisible elementals, the great elements. Self is everywhere. Because I have come to reason the self is eternal. Self is undivided. Appears as divided, as Krishna says. So this meditation. And therefore, this gives us the rationale of the implacability of law of karma. Since there is no separateness, universal harmony is an inherent law, inherent in every being. It is law of our being, the universal law of justice. So, if there is personal intent and motive, invariably it produces discord and disharmony. And the law of harmony or justice acts incessantly, brings about restoration of disturbed harmony. And during that restoration, the being who created the disturbance feels the effects of disturbance. If the causes instituted were more in accord with the good of all, then the effect will be one of happiness. The experience of the effects one receives is one of happiness. If it were more pronounced self-intent, it can not but be harmful and hurtful and obstructive to our fellow beings and creatures. Invariably it comes to be as pain. So all the pains, all the disappointments, all the obstacles that we face in life, we must realize that nobody is responsible for it. We ourselves are responsible for it. I myself desired it. Accept responsibility. So this another line of thought and action. Accept woes of birth. And therefore, in all our performance of duties, rely, fall back on the self. Rely upon the law of our being. So no matter in what condition we are, that condition is most appropriate to us. Nothing could be wiser than that. Every obstacle, every difficulty that we may face in life are necessarily created by us, and they are the very means by which we can learn, and they become the stepping stone for higher attainment and the knowledge of sowing better causes if we approach every situation in life with the right attitude and with the right aspiration, without complaint, acceptance of full responsibility. Not only our personal conditions of personal life, but also the conditions of our family life. If it were adverse, if it were full of difficulties, and we are part of the suffering of the family, then we are responsible. So is social condition in which it is. We have our responsibility. All the social evils, I cannot dissociate myself from it. So I feel the responsibility for it. Assumption of responsibility of the evils of my social life, the life of society, assumption of responsibility. Sin and shame of the world is my sin and shame. So this is the result of expanding, going out of the personal idea into the true self, which is impersonal. So this is to be practiced daily in small duties of life. You know, in your family circles, in your friend circle, in your office, in day-to-day, moment-to-moment, our dealings, this has to be kept in mind and constantly practiced. And another very important teaching which Buddha gives is getting rid of our bias. We are biased. Why we are biased? Because we are rooted in the personal idea. They call it as in Buddhist system, they call it asavas. This great flood of existence, conditioned existence, made by all this asavas, bias. Therefore, he speaks of four biases. They are bias for sensuous life. Bias for sensuous life. You know, we thirst for life. It's a bias. And from that bias, every other bias arises. Now, we have whatever accords with our long-term self-interest or short-term self-interest, we have a you know, partiality towards that. That is to be overcome. And bias for a larger life of, say, I will have a large devakanic life, enjoyment of devakanic life, and so on. So, bias for self-intent, selfishness, this is to be overcome, and it is not easy. And another important thing that we can always practice is, you know, in our daily life, in conversation, say for instance, we always like to speak about ourselves. When somebody is saying something to us about his or her experience or something relating to that person, we would like to interrupt and say something about ours. So, curb the tendency. Hear what others say. Understand what others say. Don't be too anxious and project yourself and make yourself heard. And another thing is consideration for others. Keep yourself always last and not first in everything, in every relation. So these are some of the things that you can daily practice. When somebody is sick, when you hear it, and it is your duty to give succor and relief and help, instantly obey it. So these are very small things, you know, by which we can practice impersonality. In other words, overcome the personal bias and do what is true from the perspective of universal brotherhood, the nature of the true self, and the implacable, impersonal law of karma. And lastly, brothers, we carry out our work in the ULT in a very impersonal atmosphere. Now, some people have misunderstood this impersonality to be cold towards our fellow men. It is not so at all. It is wrong. It is wrong idea of impersonality. Impersonality is being free from your personal predilections. And when we do this practice of yoga of impersonality, we become more and more intensely aware of needs of others and concern of society in general, humanity in general. That concern and sensitivity develop more. It is impersonality is freedom from personal bias. And our ULT work is carried on in an impersonal atmosphere. And this is an excellent venue, institution for us to learn this yoga of impersonality. Because here all the work is carried on keeping our personal self aside. We don't announce who is going to talk. We write articles to magazines. We don't mention who writes the articles. When we present this theosophical philosophy to the general public and inquirers, we put the philosophy before them and not unduly project ourselves between the inquirer and the truth they are seeking. So this impersonal work, this is the surest way of promoting the best interest of theosophical cause and protecting the movement from unnecessary attacks from the unthinking, careless world. So I think it is easier said than done, and let's be very definite that we are not going to succeed in the yoga of impersonality. It is a very long process, an effort protracted through many lives. So now let's conclude by
a short reading from the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which gives us an excellent view of a perfect yogi, Mahatma, who has attained to impersonality. So we must always keep such ideals in our mind and constantly try to emulate. Let me read this small portion. Arjuna asks Krishna, "What are the characteristic marks by which the man may be known, O Master, who has surpassed the three qualities? What is his course of life? And what are the means by which he overcometh the qualities?" Sri Krishna answers, "He, O son of Pandu, who doth not hate these qualities, illumination, action, delusion, when they appear, not longeth for them when they disappear, who, like one who is of no party, sitteth as one unconcerned about the three qualities and undisturbed by them, who, being persuaded that the qualities exist, is moved not by them, who is of equal mind in pain and pleasure, self-centered, to whom a lump of earth, a stone or gold are as one, who is of equal mind with those who love or dislike, constant, the same whether blamed or praised, equally minded in honor and disgrace, and the same towards friendly or unfriendly side, engaging only in necessary actions, such an one hath surmounted the qualities. And he, my servant, who worships me with exclusive devotion, having completely overcome the qualities, is fitted to be absorbed in Brahma, the Supreme. I am the embodiment of the Supreme Ruler, and of the incorruptible, of the unmodifying, and of the eternal law, and of endless bliss."